and navigation for your own switch off the main track, that you have a flag stop named after you now.
Joseph enjoyed the easy camaraderie of men, sliding effortlessly between business and social matters. The steamboats haul in the materials to build the railroads that will put them out of business. The flag stop makes it easier to ship my timber away. We have to change with the times.
The times seem to have left me behind, said Narcisse. I know you buy my land out of loyalty, not need, and I appreciate it, my young friend.
Joseph laughed.
Young indeed. 54 this summer.
He turned sober.
Don't be absurd about the land, Narcisse. It is located perfectly for my needs. Not a promising beginning to a conversation where we need to talk truth, Joseph.
Monsieur, not again.
Yes, again. You will always be my dear friend, like a son. But face facts. You cannot hold back every hot head in Grand Parish. You have enemies, Joseph, and they grow in strength and number. This is not only about you. Emily is my daughter. Those are my grandchildren. You cannot go on under the same roof.
I am not so influential as I once was. There's a new crop of men around here now, and the talk is ugly. Local and statewide petitions are being circulated to get cohabitation between the races declared a felony. Not that the locals need law on their side.
If you care about Emily and the children, you have to protect them. Provide, yes. Love them, yes. Joseph, you need to move them somewhere safer.
Joseph's face was hard.
That I will not do.
Keep them close, but marry white, Narcisse said. It is the way of things.
My position in Aloha is stronger now than in 88 when you convinced me to run, Joseph said. We keep to ourselves, we don't go together to town, we don't provoke. We just want to be left alone.
For his 55th birthday, Joseph gave himself a small party, bringing out his mandolin for the first time in months. They laid in large quantities of food and liquor and invited only his closest friends, the ones who accepted him and Emily together. It was a small and lively group, old women, young men, children, white, negro, colored. Emily enlisted the help of Philomène and Suzette in the kitchen, and Gérard came too, and Joseph invited Narcisse Frédieu, Joseph Ferrier, Antoine Morat, and Jacques Andrieux, Angélique's beau. The children were allowed to stay up late, even Mary, and everyone danced while Joseph played. Emily and Joseph sang several songs together, their high and low voices complementing each other well.
Mo! Mo! Called Narcisse, clearly enjoying both the homemade wine and the singing, and Joseph began to play Danse aux Mamamzelles.
The music and voices were so loud at first that Joseph did not hear the horses outside. Jacques, who stood closest to the window, began to quiet everyone and motioned for Joseph to stop playing.
Come on out of there, Joseph Beale.
The gay mood of the evening evaporated at the sound of the deep voice.
Take everyone to the back, Joseph whispered to Emily, and handed her his mandolin.
Emily, Philomène, Suzette, Gérard, Angélique, Thio, Josephine, Joseph, and Mary all slipped quickly into the kitchen, near the rear door. Joseph picked up his Winchester. He strode boldly out of the front door beyond the gallery, and Narcisse and the other white men from inside the house followed.
"What do you want? What are you doing on my land?" Joseph said loudly to the men on horseback. There were three of them. "Alphonse, is that you?" "Joseph, we came to talk to you quietly. No need for the gun. We didn't know you were entertaining."
"Then go on now, and we'll talk over any business later in town," Joseph said.
"This is personal,"
the lead man said.
What's going on here isn't right. It would be best for us to get down and discuss this calmly now. Just stay on your horses.
Joseph walked toward the men, his rifle in view.
Your boy enjoying the clerkship I arranged, Alphonse?
You've been good to this town, Joseph, but you can't expect us to stand for this abomination before God any longer. You have to quit it, or we can be responsible. The others wanted to make a different kind of visit here tonight. I'm here instead because of what you did for my boy.
This is my home and my land, and you have no part of that, Joseph said angrily. I'd say what happens here. Get off my property.
It'll go down hard on you, Joseph. See reason.
Narcisse walked closer to the horseman and stood directly beside Joseph. We go back a long way, Alphonse, he said.
Evening to you, Narcisse. Go on and leave now, Narcisse said. Your message has been delivered.
The lead man stared down at Narcisse and then Joseph, and turned his horse around, heading toward town. The others followed. Narcisse put his arm around Joseph's shoulder, and they walked back to the house. The party was over. 1 week later, a fire broke out in the barn, and they barely managed to get the animals out before dousing the flames. Within a month of the fire, Emily came out one early morning and found 5 of their chickens thrown onto the front gallery. Their throats were slit.
Chapter 37. In 1896, Narcisse Fredieu died of pneumonia, leaving behind a small estate laden with debt, 1 legal widow, 16 surviving children, and 8 grandchildren. His widow was forced to sell off his possessions to pay the debts, and no one expected much left over. The value of his estate was reflected in the old age and condition of his oxen and the barely usable old tools he gave to his sons Nick and Matchy before he died. The inheritance he had hoped to leave behind eluded him. For Emily, her father's presence had always meant a certain kind of immunity. As long as he was just across the river, she believed she could rise above common opinion, could confound the law. She was Joseph Beals's woman and Narcisse Fredieu's daughter, an implicit warning to others to think twice, to keep their hands to themselves. It had always meant a pass, the benefit of the doubt. Narcisse claimed race mixing as an individual right, an old school throwback, but his death coincided with a moral hardening of the times against such a minority view. His children paid him the purest homage. From oldest to youngest, colored to white, from Emily to Ed, they grieved his passing and took care of his grave. Week after week following Narcisse's burial, Emily asked her mother to visit the gravesite with her, but Philomène always refused. Finally, Philomène bent in the face of Emily's persistent appeals and consented, and Suzette went with them. Narcisse Fredieu's presence had always been an unbroken force, snaking back and forth through all their lives. Master, consort, father, tormentor, protector. It took some adjustment to conceive of a world in which he played no part. The 3 women traveled together by buggy to the Cloutierville Cemetery, a long and dusty ride. When Emily identified Narcisse's burial spot for them, Philomène stood motionless at the foot of his grave, studying the inscription on the cool, polished marker. "What does it say?" she asked. Emily read the chiseled message. It says, "Narcisse Fredieu, 1824 to 1896, beloved husband and father." The granite, ordered and paid for by Joseph Beal, gave off a mottled gray sheen of pedigree and respectability. Philomène ran her fingers across the slab. Then, with slow deliberation, she hitched back her shoulders, drew deep down into her throat, and spat on Narcisse's grave, putting her full weight into it. Calmly, she wiped her mouth with the handkerchief she kept in her dress pocket. Emily kept surprise from her face, thinking how little she knew of these women she came from, trying to do as Bet would, and listen. She studied the set to her mother's jaw, the stiff back, and saw a small flicker of confusion, an involuntary knitting of Philomène's dark eyebrows.
"He was a thief!"
Stone-faced, Philomène paced at the foot of the plot.
"He stole my youth, he stole my man, and he stole one of my children for 20 years. He made me hard. I want satisfaction."
Suzette didn't move from where she stood, the high sun full on her, no shade to be had. She shielded her eyes from the bright light with one hand and talked quietly to Philomène.
"Daughter, you always were smart, and you had the glimpsings," she said. "But you got powerful in yourself. Now Siegfried Dieu forced some of that on you."
"Are you defending him?"
Philomène said, eyes darkening against her mother.
"I do not excuse one thing the man did, but he is part of the children you're so proud of. Maybe not the best part."
Suzette tried to break the tension with a throaty chuckle. Philomène did not soften.
"You and Jérôme were the only children of mixed blood not sold away early on Rosedew, privileged among the scorned. To free, you were slave. To feel, you were house. To white, colored. And look at you now. You made a place for yourself and family. Your own land, children who can read and write. Now Siegfried Dieu is 6 feet under the ground, and you're here standing on top."
It was only 4 years until the turn of the century, and groups of night riders haunted the backwoods of central Louisiana. They were small in number, informal and inconsistent, and drew their ranks from across culture and class, from hillmen to businessmen. Most of their work was under cover of darkness, terrorizing Negroes they decided had overstepped in some way, had forgotten their place. They randomly burned, maimed, even killed, and were seldom challenged. Such was the force of their mission for racial purity that they served up reminders to white men as well. Jacques Andrieux received a visit from 3 men he did not know late one night in 1896. Rousted from a sound sleep, Jacques found himself jostled outdoors in his nightclothes.
2 of the night riders forced him down, his back to his wood-chopping stump near the house.
The 3rd man poured gasoline around his barn and set the match. Jacques helplessly watched the flame consume his property as the man who lit the match strode back casually.
"Hold his hand out flat," he barked.
On the block, wedged blade down, was Jacques' hatchet. The leader shimmied it free.
"That the hand you used to touch the nigger gal?"
Without waiting for a response, he brought the cold, sharp edge down on Jacques' little finger below the knuckle, a clean slice. The stroke seemed almost effortless.
"We don't need your kind here," he said. "We mean to keep this land pure."
Angelique came to Emily as she tied back the grapevines in the small vineyard behind the house on Beale Landing.
"Maman, Jacques is leaving to go back to France," Angelique said.
"Alone?" asked Emily. Angelique looked tired, her eyes rimmed red, her cool, pale skin drained of color beneath her sunbonnet.
"I do not want to go with him."
"He would marry you in France," Emily said. "Jacques came to Joseph to plead his case. He wants the baby born in Perpignan."
"Do you want me to go?" Angelique asked.
"I want you to think about the child. If you stay, we'll take care of both of you. But Jacques asks you to be his wife once you get to France, the way he cannot hear.
He's asking me to turn my back on family. He says to remain here punishes the child for what he calls an accident of birth. Jacques wants to bring our children up white. I won't pretend to be white, here or in France. I will not pass.
Your Uncle Eugène took that road, Emily said with sadness. She hadn't heard from her brother since he'd left Cane River for Texas.
I want to stay near you and the Grands, Angelique said. Remember Grand-Mère Elizabeth? Emily asked. The touching before she died 10 years ago?
Of course, Angelique said.
For months after, I was starved for family, and Mamère never left my thoughts. I struggled with where I belonged, and one day I would see myself as weak and alone, and the next as the sum of everyone who had come before and everyone who would come after.
Joseph tried to be helpful, but somehow I knew my comfort lay on the other side of the river, with Beth and the Grands.
Mamère Elizabeth touched each of us, Angelique, and when I understood that she was with me, in me forever, that became my inheritance, not the quilt she left to me.
Whatever you decide, to follow Jacques or stay here, you already have that inheritance too.
Jacques is not like Papa, Angelique said. He will not stay to fight.
The night raiders have become more bold, striking white men. Jacques is right to be afraid. His little finger was a warning. Only his white blood kept him from death that night. And now that the baby is obvious, Papa stood up to them.
For a moment, Emily clearly saw herself in her daughter. The blind desire for a strong man to keep her safe from the reality of the times.
Joseph has a stronger place in the community, and he and your grandfather stood up together. Narcisse Fredieu is gone now.
I told Jacques I would give him my answer by the end of the month.
Emily nodded, unsure of what Angelique would choose.
Jacques returned to France exactly 6 months after Narcisse died, leaving Angelique behind.
When the child was born, Angelique christened him Joseph after her father, the same as her brother, but they called him Buck. It was a blow to the whole family, not just Emily, when Joseph Beale married Lola Grandchamp. A settled and mature woman in her late 40s, Lola was from a marginal but old-line Natchitoches family. Never married and understandably closed-mouthed about her age, she subtracted several birthdays in her own mind over the years, and still lived with her father on a small farm near Cloutierville. Lola was of unspectacular but sufficient lineage to blot some of the stain of Joseph's scandalous behavior for the last 20 years. She was neither worldly nor clever, but she was unimpeachably white. Lola was as old-fashioned as her age implied, slightly stout in the Creole tradition, and a devout Catholic, with more pretensions to society than success in that arena. She would do for Joseph's purposes. There was speculation on both sides of the river why Lola would settle for a self-made Frenchman with such a conspicuous and dark past. Some thought it romantic that a woman her age could find true love, but they were very few. Most attributed her decision to marry Joseph to a quiet but desperate desire to change the contours of her days at home with an overbearing father and his third wife, rather than enchantment with Joseph himself, not to mention his money. Lola carried herself with a superior bearing, and her scowl in even the most joyous of times betrayed her closely held belief in the inescapable disappointments of life. She vigorously disapproved of the life Joseph Beals had lived before approaching her, and had been heard by those on the Natchitoches side of the river, emphatically condemning any mixture of the races. But she also went on to defend her fiancé, and the salvation that awaited him, now that he had chosen to denounce his sins and rejoin the white community. He was, after all, a man of some means, and, she assumed, eager to change. Emily kept up with all of this from the house on Beale Landing.
Information traveled along strange roads in the back country. Joseph never talked to her directly about his plans to marry, only about the need for Emily to move from their house. But stories of Joseph's whereabouts reached her, and she was able to follow each stage of Joseph's parallel life as he created it. The proposal, the acceptance, the setting of the wedding date, the donation in good faith to Lola Grandchamp of 850 acres of land, including the house on Beale Landing. Emily no longer worked in the store. One more public display, Joseph felt the town would not tolerate. He hired a full-time man to clerk and stock, replacing her there as he prepared to replace her elsewhere. 2 miles away, at a bend along Cornfine Bayou, Joseph built Emily a house in the middle of 74 acres he deeded to the children.
"I build a house big enough to hold Suzette and Philomène, too. They could move in with you."
"This is my house," Emily said to Joseph, waving her hand broadly to indicate the front room where they stood.
"Four of my 5 children were born here. Mary is not yet 7. Angélique, 18.
"The new house is not far," Joseph reasoned. "I will visit often, and the children can come back here any time."
Emily did not answer Joseph, busying herself elsewhere. As Joseph's wedding date approached, their conversations became more strained, with no new arguments to offer. The larger unspoken issue overwhelmed them both, exhausted them both, and by comparison, the details of day-to-day living seemed too trivial to share. The silences grew between them like the lilies that skim the surface of the swamp, spreading wider and faster in the summer heat. The new house was finished, had been finished for over 2 months, empty and in waiting for Emily to accept her part with her usual dignity. 2 days before the scheduled wedding date, Joseph came in from the woods just before nightfall. He had cut timber that day, and was spotted with the sticky amber resin from the trees, the smell of pine sap clinging stubbornly to his clothes.
"Emily, we have to move you to the other house," Joseph said. "Tomorrow."
"You better take off those overalls so I can wash them out," Emily said. "Otherwise you'll get that sap all over my good things."
"There's no more time, Tit.
I called a few of the boys to come and help get you settled in the new place tomorrow. They'll be here directly after sunup."
Emily sat down hard on the settee and cast an accusing eye on Joseph.
"How can you look at these children and toss me away? How can you look at the store? You weren't here, always in your Lyon, or off on some trip. It was me that built the store. It was me who rolled those barrels of flour until I could hardly stand up straight. It was me they held in contempt, doing the work, while they smiled in your face. Part of this is mine. Now you expect me to pick up my things and go so you can move that sour-faced white woman in here? These are my things!"
"We can move all your personals with you. Anything you want," Joseph said. "I have to do this, Emily. None of you are safe here."
"I'm not safe."
"You never have to worry. I'll take care of you and the children for the rest of your life. But there's no other way. They'll hurt us all if we go on as we've been." "I'll come see you in the new house."
Joseph took a breath. He was still standing just inside the doorway, circling his floppy sun hat around and around in his blunt-tipped hands. His movements were slow and heavy, and he had been drinking more than usual.
"She's not coming here to replace you, Tit. That's not the purpose of this. I've told her about the children. She knows how I feel about them, and they can visit. I've talked to Angélique and Théo. They're old enough to understand, especially Angélique. She and Jacques already had to make their choice."
He advanced farther into the room,
until he was close enough to reach out and touch Emily, but he kept both hands on his hat.
The little ones need to realize their father isn't abandoning them. They're what I'm proudest of in my life. We can't marry. We always knew that. And we can't live under the same roof now, either. Even your father knew, and tried to warn me when he was alive. They'll come for us, by fire, or bullet, or rope, and we won't even know who did it. It is already hard for me to do business in town. This is the way it has to be.
Emily lifted her chin.
You do this thing, and I can be held to loving you again.
Even as she spoke the words, she recognized the falsity in them. Joseph sat wearily in the straight-backed chair, as if he were a stranger in his own house. He pulled out the pint bottle of whiskey he carried during the day and lifted it to his lips. It was almost empty. Emily watched the last of the dark brown liquid disappear.
At least you'll be alive, he finally said,
wiping the wet from his mustache.
At least we'll all be alive.
He stood, slightly unsteady, and disappeared through the front door. The evening light faded, and later that night Joseph still hadn't returned. Emily started her nighttime preparations, making the rounds in the house, checking each of her children. She spent a moment looking at her portrait over the fireplace, before retiring to the bedroom, where she turned down the wick on the lamp to begin her wait for Joseph to come to the bed they had shared the entirety of her adult life. He never came. The next morning broke clear and dry, a perfect May Louisiana day. Emily had Angelique bring her a fresh wash basin of water, then sent her out to see to the children's breakfast and dress. Emily had washed, starched, and ironed everything 2 days before, and instructed them all to wear their Sunday clothes. She settled herself in front of the dressing table in her bedroom, and spent a good portion of the early morning there. Joseph could milk the cow himself. Her movements were exact, with no joy to the preening. Today she had to look her best. She was determined that the inevitable move be civil and orderly. She piled her hair high on top of her head in a loose topknot, designed to look more effortless than it really was, working faithfully to catch each stray strand that misbehaved. Laboring in front of her dressing table mirror, she heard masculine voices outside, but she did not break her morning preparations to investigate. When she was satisfied that she smelled fresh and that her hair was perfect, she called for Angelique to help pull her corset tight. She picked her best dress from the armoire, a long dark gray frock that fell to the ground in three layers, cinched tight at the waist, and accented by a jewel-buckled belt that emphasized the petiteness of her figure. The sleeves were massive and tulip-puffed at the top, in the fashion of the day, and narrowed as the material traveled the length of her arm, ending with six round buttons that sparkled if the light caught them the right way. There was delicate black lace at the cuffs, and matching black lace at the collar. It was Joseph's favorite dress. She removed her hat from its hat box and set it on the bed. Emily drew on her delicate black transparent gloves with the intricate spidery pattern. They were cut off below the knuckles and left her long, elegant fingers exposed. The gloves were the first grown-up gift Joseph had ever given to her. By the sounds, the men were gathering outside. Emily gave herself one last look into the mirror, took a deep, steadying breath, and entered the front room, where she inspected her children, each outfitted in their best visiting attire. Angelique held Buck in her arms, and from Theo all the way down to Mary, they stared at her, anxious and wide-eyed, stiff in their Sunday finery. But they did not speak. Only when she satisfied herself that they looked their best did she pull back the curtains and peer into the front yard. There were 3 buckboard wagons and several restless horses already harnessed out front. 3 white men loitered around them, looking aimless and slightly chagrined. That didn't include Joseph, who stood off to the side, alone. He still wore his work clothes from the day before. Emily recognized each of the men. Antoine Morat, Joseph Ferrier, and John Fletcher. Joseph's friends, lowly placed on society's ladder, the best he could do as long as he was with her. This had to be one of their more unpleasant chores on Joseph's behalf. These men performed his odds and ends without questions. They'd come to the house in more settled days, and she'd served them dinner and wine at her table, or provided a cool drink after they'd witnessed a business transaction, or moved oxen from one pen to another. Often they came just to drink and tell lies to pass an evening. Today they waited for Joseph's command to move her away. She gathered up the smallest ones, Mary and little Joseph and Josephine. Emily wanted her family above reproach. Keep a close eye on them, Angélite. I'll take care of you, Mère. Theo stepped forward, serious in his black suit, starched white shirt, and floppy black tie. I'll find a way to take care of all of us. His eyes were like coal, blazing from his ashen face with the bravado of a frightened man-boy of 15. A lock of his sandy hair had defied the comb. She licked her fingers and smoothed it back. You are the man of the family now, but today we do this my way, Emily answered. Help Angélite mind after your sisters and brother. I don't want any talking or crying in front of those men, not by any of us. Keep everyone in the house and keep them quiet. Will you do that for me, Theo? Oui, Mama. Thank you. Emily smoothed her dress one more time. She tilted up her chin, pushed back her shoulders, and slowly stepped outside onto the front gallery. Monsieur Joseph, these are my rose bushes. How will you give them to me? She kept her voice strong, as if she were exchanging pleasantries with a shopkeeper. They all turned to look, 6 pairs of eyes from inside the house, and 4 from outside. Come now, Emilie, Joseph said. We're going to move whatever you want. You just take these boys in the house with you and point out what you need. We have plenty of space in the wagons. The horse in the barn is mine, given to me by my father. And I'm not going anywhere without my rose bushes. We can dig up some of the bushes so you can replant them at the new house. It has to be before 3 o'clock, Emily said. What? Joseph said. You know it's bad luck to touch the roses after 3 o'clock, Emily said. The roses are your responsibility. Emily, don't do this! Joseph shifted his weight forward and looked directly at her. His tone turned hard and dangerous, caught between his 2 audiences. Without further word, Emily went back into the house, leaving the door open behind her. There seemed to be no motion anywhere, inside or out, except for hers. Her children watched her carefully, waiting. The oil painting mocked her from its position of honor over the fireplace in the front room. She allowed herself only an instant to wonder at the strange, overconfident girl captured on canvas, hand resting lightly on the chair, staring out at a future full of promise. Emily moved quickly. She had to drag a chair over and stand on tiptoe, working at the hook and wire to get the portrait down. She didn't call on anyone to help her, and each was hesitant to come to her aid, unasked. The painting had never been removed before, and the rectangular patch of wallpaper underneath looked fresh and new compared with the familiar pattern exposed to the air and sun. Emily gently placed the painting next to her rocking chair and sat down calmly. Come, she said to her children, trying to give a reassuring smile, motioning to the couch and chairs. They followed suit and sat down tentatively, alternating between keeping their eyes down and glancing apprehensively at this tiny woman who was their mother. As if a signal had been given, the men moved inside. It was Joseph who decided what went to the new house. Emily asked for nothing other than the rose bushes, her horse, and the painting. She was unresponsive to questions the men put to her, and they stopped asking. She rocked. The men edged around them, reluctantly, throwing guarded glances toward her and the silent children, loading those things that Joseph pointed out. Except for Antoine Morat. He caught Emily's eye once when Joseph was in another room, and Emily was sure she saw a slight gloat to his smile. The men loaded up all of the children's beds, miscellaneous furniture, lanterns, and most of the kitchenware. One of the wagons was for livestock, hogs and chickens, and they tied a milking cow behind it. Last, Joseph loaded up her dressing table and the rocking chair she had been sitting in, both gifts he had given in happier days. They used the lead wagon for the human cargo. Joseph Beals's family, Emily, children, and grandchild, were helped into the buckboard and began the journey to their new home, 2 miles away. Joseph himself drove the horses forward, in silence, and the other wagons followed. The strange caravan made its way from the riverside of Aloha over to the wooded side on Cornfine Bayou, where the new house waited. When they arrived, the men began to unload and carry the heaviest furniture into the house.
"Come to the barn, Tite. This is important," Joseph said.
He untethered Emily's dapple-gray horse from the back of the wagon and led him to the barn. Emily left the children in the wagon and followed. Out of sight and earshot of the others, Joseph pulled a package from the saddlebag and handed Emily a small canvas bag.
"There's $500 in cash here, Tite. Don't let anyone know you have it, and hide it well. If there's anything you need, just send Tio over. He can come for me any time, to the house, or the store, or the mill."
"It appears that suddenly you see the wisdom in me having money of my own," Emily said, but there was no satisfaction in it. She stuffed the sack between 2 piles of hay and collected her children out of the hot sun. Tio drew up water from the well, and they waited in the barn until the men left. Before going into the new house for the first time, Emily dampened the roots of the rose bushes the men had left leaning against the gallery.
"We will replant them along the side of the house first thing in the morning," Emily said to her children. "There is never any excuse for a bare dirt yard."
Joseph Beale married Lola Grandchamp the next day in a small private ceremony in Cloutierville, and brought his bride back to his house on Beale Landing. To the townspeople, Joseph Beale had mended his ways and married White, a signal that it was safe to return to the substance of their own pursuits. Chapter 38. 2 weeks after the incident at Beale Landing, on a muggy midsummer day, Tio came to Philomène's farm. Suzette sat on the front gallery, snapping beans for supper, and she could feel her great-grandson's misery even before he got off his horse. Tio dismounted, respected her politely by tipping his hat, and went straight away to the side garden where Philomène tended the tomatoes.
"It's Maman," Suzette overheard Tio say. "She will not get up from her bed. She won't eat."
"Does she have fever?" Philomène asked. Alarm made her voice rise.
Tio reddened.
"It isn't urgent. She's not that kind of sick."
Philomène brushed past Tio without stopping to take off her work gloves or change her bonnet. Harnessing the mare, she called to Suzette.
"I will be back when I get to the bottom of this."
Philomène rode straight saddle in the direction of Emily's new house on Cornfine Bayou, Tio straining to keep up on his horse beside her. Night had fallen, and the full moon was high when Philomène returned alone, worry chiseled across her forehead.
We must act quickly, Maman, she said to Suzette. The girl is hurt. She needs us near. Emily doesn't know what it is to be without a man, crying all day for what is already gone.
Emily could move back here, Suzette said. We can make room.
No, said Philomène.
Joseph put the land in the name of the children. If she leaves the property, even for a short while, there could be trouble later. We must move there.
Suzette knew Philomène well enough to know she had already decided on some course of action and would be almost impossible to sway. She protested anyway.
There are 12 years of sweat, prayers, and Sunday dinners put into this house.
Philomène untied and removed her bonnet, and Suzette noticed for the first time a lone grey strand in her daughter's hair.
I made the arrangement already with Monsieur Bill, said Philomène, putting aside the sweat-stained hat, her face hard. That was the reason for my delay. I agreed to sell him this property, minus a piece for Beth to stay on as her own. In exchange, we get land on the other side of the river next to Emily's.
She struck a more conciliatory tone.
We earned every acre here, Mama, and it served us well. But this parcel was the poorest of Narcisse's land, ringed by swamps. It gave our family a start, but most have gone on to their own lives now, or died, and the farm is getting to be too much for us alone. We'll have less land, but the soil around Emily's new place is richer, the house bigger and already built.
I am old, almost at the end of life, and you would uproot me again?
Suzette heard the whine in her own voice. Although she spoke the words, and her mind could reach back over 7 decades, it was almost impossible for Suzette to accept herself as an old woman. Time had forced her to create a special place in her mind for death, a place already packed to overflowing, so many of the people who shaped her already gathered there. Elizabeth, her sister Palmyre, Gerasim, Nicolas Moulon, Marraine d'Oralise, Auréline d'Urban, Narcisse Frédieu. She had outlived them all.
We can bear the move across the river to Confin Bayou for Emily.
Philomène stood unwavering in the face of Suzette's resistance.
Family does for family, and young life around will do us both good.
The night before the move, Suzette rummaged in her private storage, a cigar box where she kept her special things. Inside was a broken string of white rosary beads, an old oak figurine Jérôme had carved, and her tatted lace handkerchief. She removed the shabby cowhide strip Nicolas had given her and rubbed it for luck. Memories of long-ago days broke free. She felt her whole life had been spent traveling from one cramped space to another. Always there seemed to be a next place. As Philomène checked the house before turning into bed, she came upon Suzette reflecting.
"You seem lost in thought," she said, entering the room.
"I've been thinking about a last name," Suzette said.
"You have a last name, Maman? Madame Moulon."
"If I can pack up and start afresh at my age," Suzette said, "I can change my last name."
One of the few advantages of growing old, she decided, was the freedom hidden in it. People seemed to relax their expectations, suddenly allowing so much more, word or deed.
"Mère Elizabeth is gone, bless her soul, and Nicolas' people never did want me to be one of them. There's no need to hang on to Jackson or Moulon. From now on, everyone is to call me Suzette de Negre."
It amused Suzette to take a new name, especially one of her own making, insisting they all call her by something entirely different. If she felt like it, she might even change her last name again. If she felt like it. At Emily's new house, Suzette took as a personal campaign the effort to save the transplanted rose bushes whose flowers were wilted and drooping since the short journey from Beale Landing to Cornfine Bayou. She pruned back the stems to the five-leaf, slow-soaked the bushes to encourage deep rooting, and set traps for beetles. Already she saw improvement. All of the women shared chores, helped tend Emily's children, looked after the chickens and livestock, put in a vegetable garden. Family Sunday dinners moved with Philomène and Suzette to the other side of Red River, to Cornfine Bayou. In the beginning, the house was unfamiliar, and Suzette had great difficulty keeping still in bed. From her room, she listened to the night's quiet sounds, or pushed her feet into slippers to walk the house before returning to bed. One night, prowling noiselessly down the narrow hallway toward the kitchen, she heard the subdued hum of conversation. Philomène's reassuring voice played counterpoint to Emily's hollow-toned dejection. Not wanting to disturb their intimacy, Suzette stayed silent, listening.
"It is difficult for you to believe at this moment, but you can survive this," Philomène said. Emily's voice sounded limp. "I know you mean well, Mama, but you can't understand. There is no happiness left for me. Surviving isn't enough. You have never allowed sadness around you, child. It will be that way again." "Why, Mama?" Emily asked. "Why would you give up your farm to move here?"
"A family belongs together.
Beth is on the other side of the river.
Beth doesn't have the same kind of pain."
Philomène sighed heavily.
"Emily, I understand the suckhole loneliness makes after love disappoints. Ma mère Suzette and I can help."
"This is nothing you can mend. Joseph has left me, humiliated me."
Emily's voice threatened to break.
"Even so, I still want him."
"That will play out in its own way, in its own time. For now, it's you and the children that matter."
There was a long pause, and Suzette heard the pouring of coffee, the soft scraping of a cup replaced on the table.
"Emily, there is one thing you must never forget. You do not come from fragile stock."
Suzette thought then of her own mother, how her death left an emptiness even now, but had brought young Emily closer. Maybe this was the lesson each generation had to learn, over and over again. Where the strength began, and how it kept itself alive. Philomène's voice was low and soothing, almost crooning.
"I am the rock in your garden, Emily, and you are the bloom in mine. Count on me."
Suzette quietly retraced her steps down the hall to her room, leaving mother and daughter alone in the kitchen. Life went on, for all of them. It took time, but the flush came back to Emily's cheeks, and the Sunday came when she sang and danced for them again. Joseph reappeared in their lives. The first reasons given for his visits were to make repairs to the house on Cornfine Bayou, or to bring gifts for the grandchild, but finally the detailed excuse-making fell away, and his appearances became frequent and accepted. As a new bride still in the habit of trying to please her husband, Lola Grandchamp reluctantly permitted the children to visit their father at Beale Landing 3 or 4 times a year, at Joseph's insistence, but even then they couldn't enter the house. Before allowing them to go, Emily examined each of them, inspecting their freshly washed hair, the press of their Sunday best clothes, the polish to their shoes. Only then could they leave their house on Cornfine Bayou, the 6 of them together, Angelique, Tio, Josephine, Joe, and Mary, with Buck in Angelique's arms, eagerly setting off for Beale Landing, a family adventure. As Buck got older, he walked alongside them through the woods. The house on Cornfine Bayou emptied out by 6, leaving behind 3 older generations of women, Suzette, Philomène, and Emily. Tio brought back reports of Lola sitting off to one side in the deepest shade of the gallery, while Joseph basked in the center of the circle of his children. It was an uneasy truce for all of them, but they managed. For years, they all managed. Angélique entertained the attentions of several suitors. She settled on Denis Couty, a tall, lanky-colored farmer with an even disposition, as fair of skin as she. He was a neighbor, a sharecropper, and wanted from the first to make her his wife. Angélique broke new ground in the family by marrying Denis, and soon afterward becoming pregnant, in that order. She lived with her new husband on his plot, and was close enough to walk to Emily's house every day. The couple often took supper there. Theo worked in the sawmill, with no greater ambition than a little money in his pocket, but he had a restless disposition like his father. He passed all the way into his late teens, committed to no one thing in particular, and often went off by himself, appearing and disappearing at will. He was a polite and self-effacing young man, handsome in a gentle way, but he kept his own counsel. Theo was never quite the same after the move from Beale Landing, except with Angélique. Only his sister seemed to coax him toward liveliness, keep him from brooding, from going into himself too deeply. With Angélique, he laughed and even joked. Josephine and Mary, young women 5 years apart, were so compatible that it became difficult to think of them separately. They preferred their own company to any other. Both were shy, with outsiders. The girls seemed content around the farm. Joe Jr. grew tall, so confident in himself that they began to call him Man. The most forward of the colored girls in the small community competed for his notice, and he encouraged the attention, unable to resist a pretty face. But he never allowed himself to become entirely distracted from learning all he could to be able to follow in his father's footsteps. Joe had Joseph Beale's drive, did well in school, and worked hard at his lessons. The turn of the century came and went, and they set up their own routines on Cornfine Bayou, mixing in the past and the future. The young outnumbered the old, and they all prepared for the imminent arrival of Angélique's second child. Angélique delivered a small, weak son, but they lost her in childbirth. After a long and difficult birth, passing from one day into the next, life and death made an unbearable trade. It was then that Suzette began to feel she had spent enough time with both the living and the dead, that to outlive a great-granddaughter meant she had surely gone on for too long. The death place in her mind was over full. They mourned on Cornfine Bayou, a deep and profound grief, but the demands of the living trumped the call of the dead. Emily plunged headlong into the raising of her two orphaned grandsons, a woman's concession to the caprices of life. Philomène spent extra hours in the kitchen preparing food, forcing everyone to eat. Little Buck wrapped his bony arms around their necks, and they consoled him in turns. The old women had children to raise, food to put on the table, the farm to run, and each other. Josephine and Mary grew more inseparable every day. Joe, the clever son, was smart and popular, surrounded always by friends as well as family, and found his solace there. Everyone else had someone but Theo, and Angélique had been the natural pairing in the family while she lived, his confidant. And after she died, Theo's absences from the house became longer and more frequent. Joseph Beale started to come apart, an alarmingly rapid deterioration. Overnight, he took on an old man's shuffle, halting, tentative, losing a full inch of his height. Weight vanished from his too thin frame, the flesh covering his gaunt cheeks pulled overly tight across his face, his brooding eyes pronounced and watery. With Angélique gone, a neediness opened in Joseph so profound
that it seemed to push aside caution. He couldn't get enough of his remaining children and summoned them more often to the house on Beale Landing. The unbearable tension there between Joseph and Lola grew tauter than a hangman's noose, with Joseph seemingly oblivious of the hostility Lola directed toward the six of them in their Sunday finery when they marched en masse through the gate. They went whenever summoned, still six, with Angelique gone, and little Ernest added. Chapter 39. Joseph sent word to Cornfine Bayou that he requested the presence of his children on the upcoming Saturday at Beale Landing, the first anniversary of Angelique's death. They were their customary six, outfitted in Sunday best, dresses and shirts starched and ironed, shoes polished, backs stiff, even in the heat. They sat on the edges of their chairs along the cramped gallery, and Joseph held Ernest on his lap. Tio, the oldest of the Beale children now, was 24. Mary, at 15, was the youngest, and Angelique's baby, Ernest, celebrated his one-year birthday. Joseph made idle conversation while Lola fanned herself on the far side of the gallery. When he cleared his throat and coughed grandly, a staged sound meant to signal an announcement, Tio put down his coffee cup.
"As my natural children and grandchildren," Joseph said, "this land is to be yours when I die."
Lola let out a small, surprised gasp and quickly pulled her lace handkerchief to her mouth, as if by doing so she could swallow Joseph's offending words and make them disappear. She stood, all eyes now on her, and after an awkward moment of apparent disorientation, fled into the house, the petticoats under her cotton dress rustling violently. The next time the six came to Beale Landing, instead of her regular spot at the far end of the gallery, Lola refused to appear. But she was a presence just the same, perched inside the front room with the front door ajar and the outer screen door latched shut, a pair of listening ears and a voice that could lash out at them whenever she chose.
"Mongrels," Lola said midway through the visit.
Her voice was distinct, the word clear to everyone on the gallery.
"Mongrels," she repeated, more loudly this time. "More of that trashy life you led before me. I won't be a party to it. I don't want them on my property." "Woman, shut that noise," Joseph said as if to the air.
He had been drinking, and there was a slight slurring to his words.
"You know whose property this is, and I'll have anyone I please here. These are my children."
He made a show of bouncing Ernest on his knee until the toddler, too young to understand the mood, grinned his delight. After that day, the invitations to the house on Beale Landing were withdrawn. No more summons, no need for Tio to slick back his hair or polish his shoes. Joseph asked them to stop coming to the house, showing up instead more often on Cornfine Bayou. The rains were heavy, and it was a nasty, wintry day at the tail end of January. Tio was grateful for the protection of his everyday fedora. As a boy, he had run these same woods, but the groves were thicker then, the trees so close together that they kept out the light and either dampened some of summer's oppressive heat or provided shelter from the worst of winter's downpours. The pines had been thinned since those days. His pace was unhurried but deliberate, and he sorted through plausible explanations for why he was in this part of the woods at this time of the afternoon. He could say he was taking a shortcut to his mother's or uncle's house for early supper, or running an errand to borrow a blade from Mr. Ephraim over to the sawmill, or on his way to pick up a sack of salt. Now and then on his visits, he came across men on foot or on horseback, usually his father's renters or men otherwise in Joseph Beale's employ. Some were friendly enough, stopping to make small talk, happy to run into another soul in the back country
and some just passed without speaking. It was a small community, and most knew who he was, and he knew them. There were times when he heard someone approach and hid until they passed, but more often than not, he didn't see anyone, coming or going. When he had first started the visits, his fear of discovery had been strong. Now Tio didn't worry about this part of the journey. He knew these woods as well as he knew the habits of the catfish in the river. Still, it wouldn't do to be caught this far into Joseph Beale's property without a reason ready to his tongue. The rhythm of the visits had settled into a familiar pattern, always starting with a vague feeling of restlessness just beyond his grasp, as if something deep inside were fighting to be given its due, as though he were trying to remember some important promise made to a friend that kept sliding away because the doing had been left off for too long. That feeling could last for hours, or it could last for days, until the sharp jolt of anxiety and panic gripped him and would not allow him to sit still. The need to take action pained him in a physical way, in the twisting of his stomach or the pounding of his head. When the pattern first started, he hadn't known how to help himself. By now he understood that whatever else he had been doing would have to wait, no matter whether it was night or day, storm or clear, winter or summer, convenient or no. He needed to start on the path out to his father's house for the visit. As soon as he rounded the last bend and saw the roof of the house, his heart sped. The house had power over him, fear, anger, and anticipation all balled up in a knot with each breath he took. His reaction was the same every time, as if it were the first. Tio tasted that knot as it rose from deep in his belly, up into his throat, and threatened to choke him. What kind of life was this for a 26-year-old man? For 2 years now he had spied on his father and his father's wife. The urgency started from the first week Joseph had told him not to come to his house on Beale Landing any more, that he and the others were no longer welcome there. 10 years had come and gone since Joseph had brought his wife from St. John the Baptist Catholic Church in Cloutierville across the river to the house on Beale Landing. Direct from the wedding ceremony to the house that had been Tio's home just the day before. Tio decided to take his position behind the chicken house, his favorite site when the weather was wet. He could use the eaves to keep the rain off and still have an unobstructed view of the screen-enclosed gallery. Tio knew all of the comfortable places to hide around the perimeter of the house on Beale Landing, each giving him a different vantage point of the grounds. When he had first been pulled to Beale Landing, Tio sometimes kept to his position for almost an entire day, just for the possibility of a momentary glance of Joseph or Lola. Now it was enough to know that the house entwined them both in unhappiness with each other. Their sorrow was his tonic. Sometimes it took only a few minutes for the weight of the house to take hold, for him to feel soothed and strong enough to take his life back, and he could head back home without so much as shifting out of his original crouch-like stance. He never stayed more than a few hours any more. Joseph often left early in the morning and stayed away late into the night. Sometimes he came home for dinner or supper, but many times he did not, and they had few visitors. In the last 2 years since the banishment, Lola had also made clear that Joseph's society marginal friends were no longer welcome in the house. When his old acquaintances needed work, gossip, or favors, they intercepted Joseph elsewhere or called out from the gate to see if anybody was home without entering the front yard or climbing the steps. Even as Tio approached the chicken house, he heard voices from the gallery. It was Antoine and Joseph arguing. Tio quickly hid himself deeper in the shadows, but he could still hear. "Be reasonable." Antoine's voice was honey. "I am your closest relative here. 2,000 acres cannot fall into hands incapable of overseeing it properly. My children are my closest relatives,"
Joseph said. They cannot inherit.
How is it you have come to be so familiar with the law?
It is common knowledge, your foolishness about the inheritance.
Antoine did not keep the disapproval from his voice.
I would administer it on their behalf.
Theo lost a few words when Joseph lowered his voice, but he picked up the thread again.
We won't do any more business together, Antoine. There's no use working with a man you can't trust. I was the one who made it possible for you and your family to come to this country, and this is how you repay me?
Some would say it was money owing, Antoine said, but now his voice was strained and harsh.
You talk trust. People in town want to do business with me now. It's me they trust. You insist on turning your back on your own kind. Even now, it's not decent.
Do not ever come back to my house, Joseph said.
Theo heard Antoine mount his horse and ride away to the east, and then the bang of the screen door as Joseph retreated into the house. Theo thought about Antoine Morat for most of his walk back to Cornfine Bayou. Since he was a small boy, whenever white men frightened him, it was Antoine Morat's face attached to the menace. Antoine was part of a blurry memory Theo carried of his grandfather Narcisse pushing him out of his lap in the cool of an evening long ago, before his father went away to New Orleans. Antoine was one of the men who had moved them out of the house on Beale Landing 12 years before. All of the colored in the area knew Antoine could be mean and high-handed, and he was one of the white men in town calling for a cleaner separation between Joseph and Emily. But it was A.J. Morat, Antoine's son, whom Theo hated. 5 years younger than Theo, and born to a life of white privilege Theo could only dream of, A.J. was away at medical school while Theo picked up odd jobs at the sawmill. Joseph had always been conspicuous in his affection and admiration for the boy, and lavish in his desire to provide him opportunities in life. Theo sometimes felt as if his very life were being stolen away, as if every time he tried to draw fresh air into his lungs, something tightened its grip around his body like a snake slowly crushing its prey. They took their toll, the menial tasks at the sawmill, the spying that only confirmed the contempt people harbored for his family, his corrosive longing for other people's lives, the unquenchable need for his father. And he was drawn to the same cycle again and again. The jitteriness, the pull, the walk, the pounding heart, bitterness confronted, the numbing calm, and the long walk home. He remembered happier times, when they all lived in their house together, and his mother would laugh and clap and dance to the tunes his father played on his mandolin, how they would all sing together. But he also remembered his father's absences and his mother taking on the back-breaking work. It was like hitching up a butterfly to pull a plow. By the time Theo reached halfway between the house on Beale Landing and Cornfine Bayou, he was calm enough to think about how to break the cycle of the visits. Joseph and Lola were still miserable together, and Antoine had been dismissed from his father's business. The next time the nervousness beckoned, he would fight the urge and get on with his life, the way other people managed to do. He would find a good woman and marry. They would settle down and have children. There were jobs at the sawmill or the railroad, enough to support a family. He would begin his life again on his own terms. It all seemed possible. There was almost a lightness in his step by the time he set foot on Cornfine Bayou. Maybe he had taken his last visit. The pressure in his stomach was relieved, and his head was full of the possibility that evil could be punished, that good things could unfold for him, too. 2 weeks later, Theo was pulled back to Beale Landing, the cycle unbroken. From his position behind the chicken house, he had a partial view when Joseph appeared at the front door of the main house mid-morning, walking his old man shuffle. He made for the barn, saddled his horse, and rode off in the direction of the sawmill. Only minutes later, as if they were waiting, Antoine Morat rode onto the property with another man Tio didn't recognize. The unknown man had a professional air about him. When he took off his hat, a great shock of black hair curled around his face, thick as a horse's mane, setting off little gold-framed glasses that perched at the bridge of his thin nose. He had on a dark jacket and matching trousers, a suit that looked as if it couldn't carry the weight of an honest day's work, and thin-soled shoes. With a confident gesture, the man pulled a sheaf of papers from his jacket pocket and tapped them against Antoine's sleeve before Lola let them inside. Something was seriously wrong. Wrong enough that he needed to tell someone what he had seen. Tio was sure these men were up to no good. Chapter 40 Emily was the last awake, the last one up for the night, in a slow, restless prowl around the house when she heard the disturbance from the front gallery. It was no doubt Joseph, his high-strung disposition stretched to breaking. He drank too much of late, she thought, the liquor making him absent and vague, but it took him beyond the sting his life had become.